There were three quite exceptional houses in the country, and Mara Motswe felt some satisfaction that she had been invited to two of them. The best known of these was Mokolodi, a rambling chateau-like building to the south of Habrone. This house was probably the grandest establishment in the country, and was certainly rather more impressive than Pakadi House to the north, which is rather too close to the sewage ponds for Mara Motswe's taste. The third house could only be suspected of being a house of distinction, as very few people were invited to enter it, and Habrone as a whole had to rely on what could be seen of the house from the outside, which was not much, as it was surrounded by a high white wall, or on reports from those who were summoned into the house for some special purpose. These reports were unanimous in their praise for the sheer opulence of the interior.
"Like Buckingham Palace,"
said one woman who had been called to arrange flowers for some family occasion.
"Only I think that the Queen lives a bit more simply than those people in there."
The people in question were the family of Mr. Paliwala Sundigar Patel, the owner of 8 stores, 5 in Habrone and 3 in Francistown, a hotel in Orapa and a large outfitter's in Lobatse. He was undoubtedly one of the wealthiest men in the country, but amongst the Botswana, this counted for little, as none of the money had gone into cattle, and money which was not invested in cattle, as everybody knew, was but dust in the mouth. There were 4 children, a son, Wallace, 2 daughters, Sandri and Pali, and the youngest, a daughter called Nandira. Wallace had been sent to an expensive boarding school in Zimbabwe in order to satisfy Mr. Patel's ambition that he become a gentleman. There he had learned to play cricket and to be cruel. He had been admitted to dental school after a large donation by Mr. Patel and had then gone to Durban, where he set up a practice in cosmetic dentistry. At some point he had shortened his name, for convenience's sake, and had become Mr. Wallace Pate, BDS, Natal. Mr. Patel had protested at the change.
"Why are you now this Mr. Wallace Pate, BDS, Natal, may I ask? Why? You ashamed or something? You think I'm just a Mr. Paliwalar Patel, BA, failed or something?"
"Short names are easier, Father. Pate, Patel, it's the same thing. The modern idea is to be brief. We must be modern these days. Everything is modern, even names."
There had been no such pretensions from the twins. They had both been sent back to the Natal from which Mr. Paliwala Patel came to meet husbands, which they had done in the manner expected by their father. Both sons-in-law had now been taken into the business and were proving to have a good head for figures and a sound understanding of the importance of tight profit margins. Then there was Nandira, who was 16, and a pupil at Maruapula School in Habrone, the best and most expensive school in the country. She was bright academically and was expected to make a good marriage in the fullness of time, probably on her 20th birthday, which Mr. Patel had felt was precisely the right time for a girl to marry. The entire family, including the sons-in-law, the grandparents and several distant cousins, lived in the Patel mansion near the old Botswana Defence Force Club. In fact, it was several houses linked together, all forming the family compound.
"The Indians like to live in a compound," Mr. Patel had explained to the architect. "We like to be able to see what's going on in the family, you know."
The architect designed a house in which he indulged every architectural whimsy which more demanding and less well-funded clients had suppressed over the years. To his astonishment, Mr. Patel accepted everything, and the resulting building was furnished in what could only be called Delhi Rococo, with a great deal of gilt in furniture and curtains, and on the walls expensive pictures of Hindu saints and mountain deer with eyes that followed one about the room. When the twins married, the sons-in-law were each given a red Mercedes-Benz with their initials on the driver's door. This required the Patel garage to be expanded, as there were now 4 Mercedes-Benz cars to be housed there. Mr. Patel's, Mrs. Patel's car, driven by a driver, and the 2 belonging to the sons-in-law. An elderly cousin had said to him at the wedding in Durban,
"Look, men, we Indians have got to be careful. You shouldn't go flashing your money around the place. The Africans don't like that, you know. And when they get the chance, they'll take it all away from us. Look at what happened in Uganda. Imagine what the Zulus would do to us if they had half a chance. We've got to be discreet.
Mr. Patel had shaken his head.
None of that applies in Botswana. They're stable people. You should see them, with all their diamonds. Diamonds bring stability to a place, believe me.
But Mr. Patel had taken the warning to heart, to an extent, and had added to the height of the wall surrounding his house so that people could not look in the windows and see the luxury. And if they continued to drive around in their big cars, well, there were plenty of those in town, and there was no reason why they should be singled out for special attention. Mara Motswe was delighted when she received the telephone call from Mr. Patel, asking her whether she could possibly call on him some evening in the near future. They agreed upon that very evening, and she went home to change into a more formal dress. You could not just push open the gate at the Patel house, nor could you park outside and hoot your horn, as everybody did with other houses. At the Patel house, you pressed a bell in the wall, and a high-pitched voice issued from a small speaker above your head.
Yes, Patel Place here. What do you want?
Ma Ramotswe, she said. There was another crackling sound, and the gate began to swing open. Ma Ramotswe had left her tiny white van round the corner to keep up appearances, and so she entered the compound by foot. Inside, she found herself in a courtyard which had been transformed by shade netting into a grove of lush vegetation. At the far end of the courtyard was the entrance to the house itself, a large doorway flanked by tall white pillars and tubs of plants. Mr. Patel appeared before the open door and waved to her with his walking stick. She had seen Mr. Patel before, of course, and knew that he had an artificial leg, but she had never seen him at really close quarters and had not expected him to be so small. Mara Motswe was not tall, but Mr. Patel still found himself looking up at her when he shook her hand and gestured for her to come inside.
"Have you been in my house before?" he asked, knowing, of course, that she had not. "Have you been at one of my parties?"
This was a lie as well, she knew. Mr. Patel never gave parties, and she wondered why he should pretend to do so. "No," she said simply. "You have never asked me."
"Oh, dear," he said, chuckling. "I have made a big mistake." "We shall go through to my study," he said. "That is my private room, in which none of the family are ever allowed."
The study was a large room, dominated by a large desk, on which there were three telephones and an elaborate pen and ink stand, which consisted of several glass shelves for the pens, the shelves being supported by miniature elephant tusks, carved in ivory.
"Sit down, please," said Mr. Patel, pointing to a white leather armchair. "Takes me a little time to sit, because I'm missing one leg. I'm always on the lookout for a better leg. This one is Italian and cost me a lot of money, but I think there are better legs to be had, maybe in America."
Mara Motswe sank into the chair and looked at her host.
"I'll get straight to the point," said Mr. Patel. "There's no point in beating about the bush and chasing all sorts of rabbits, is there?"
"No, there isn't."
Mara Motswe nodded her head slightly.
"I'm a family man, Mara Motswe," he said. "I have a happy family who all live in this house, except for my son, who is a gentleman dentist in Durban. But my other children are also very important to me. I make no distinction between my children. They are all the same. Equal, equal."
"That's the best way to do it," said Mara Motswe. "If you favor one, then that leads to a great deal of bitterness."
"You can say that again, oh yes," said Mr. Patel. "Children notice when their parents give two sweets to one and one to another. They can count, same as us."
Mara Motswe nodded, wondering where the conversation was leading.
"Now," said Mr. Patel, "my little Nandira is 16, and she is at Maru Apula. She's doing well at school, but..."
He paused, looking at Mara Motswe through narrowed eyes.
"You know how things are with teenagers in these modern days."
Mara Motswe shrugged.
They are often bad trouble for their parents. I have seen parents crying their eyes out over their teenagers.
Mr. Patel suddenly lifted his walking stick and hit his artificial leg for emphasis. The sound was surprisingly hollow and tinny.
That's what is worrying me, he said vehemently, and I will not have that, not in my family.
What? Asked Mara Motswe. Teenagers?
Boys, said Mr. Patel bitterly. My Nandira is seeing some boy in secret. She denies it, but I know that there is a boy, and this cannot be allowed in this family, in this house. I have spoken to her, he said. I told her that I don't care what other children are doing. That is their parents' business, not mine. But I have made it very clear that she is not to go about the town with boys or see boys after school. That is final.
He looked at Mara Motswe expectantly. Mara Motswe cleared her throat. You want me to do something about this? She said quietly. Is this why you have asked me here this evening? Mr. Patel nodded.
I want you to find out who this boy is, and then I will speak to him.
Mara Motswe stared at Mr. Patel. She had heard about Indian fathers trying to arrange marriages, but she had never actually encountered such behaviour. And here was Mr. Patel, assuming that she would agree with him, that she would take exactly the same view.
Wouldn't it be better to speak to her? She asked gently. If you asked her who the young man was, then she might tell you.
Mr. Patel tapped his tin leg.
Not at all,
he said sharply, his voice becoming shrill.
Not at all! I have already been asking her for 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, and she gives no answer. She is dumb insolent.
Mara Motswe sat and looked down at her feet, aware of Mr. Patel's expectant gaze upon her. She had decided to make it a principle of her professional life never to turn anybody away, unless they asked her to do something criminal. This rule appeared to be working. She had already found that her ideas about a request for help, about its moral rights and wrongs, had changed when she had become more aware of all the factors involved. It might be the same with Mr. Patel, but even if it were not, were there good enough reasons for turning him down? Who was she to condemn an anxious Indian father when she really knew very little about how these people ran their lives? She felt a natural sympathy for the girl, of course. What a terrible fate to have a father like this one, intent on keeping one in some sort of gilded cage. Her own daddy had never stood in her way over anything. He had trusted her, and she, in turn, had never kept anything from him, apart from the truth about Note, perhaps. She looked up. Mr. Patel was watching her with his dark eyes, the tip of his walking stick tapping almost imperceptibly on the floor.
I'll find out for you, she said. Although I must say, I don't really like the idea of watching a child.
But children must be watched, expostulated Mr. Patel. If parents don't watch their children, then what happens? You answer that.
There comes a time when they must have their own lives, said Mara Motswe. We have to let go.
Nonsense, shouted Mr. Patel. Modern nonsense. My father beat me when I was 22. Yes, he beat me for making a mistake in the shop, and I deserved it. None of this modern nonsense.
Mara Motswe rose to her feet.
I am a modern lady, she said, so perhaps we have different ideas, but that has nothing to do with it. I have agreed to do as you have asked me. Now all that you need to do is to let me see a photograph of this girl so that I can know who it is I'm going to be watching.
Mr. Patel struggled to his feet.
No need for a photograph, he said. I can produce the girl herself. You can look at her.
Mara Motswe raised her hands in protest.
But then she will know me, she said. I must be able to be unobserved.
Ah,
said Mr. Patel.
A very good idea. You detectives are very clever men.
Women, said Mara Motswe.
Mr. Patel looked at her sideways but said nothing. He had no time for modern ideas.
As she left the house, Mara Motswe thought, he has 4 children. I have none. He is not a good father, this man, because he loves his children too much. He wants to own them. You have to let go. You have to let go.
And she thought of that moment when, not even supported by Note, who had made some excuse, she had laid the tiny body of their premature baby, so fragile, so light, into the earth, and had looked up at the sky, and wanted to say something to God, but couldn't, because her throat was blocked with sobs, and no words, nothing, would come. It seemed to Mara Motswe that it would be a rather easy case. Nandira would be at school for most of the day, of course, and that meant that Mara Motswe could get on with other things until 3 o'clock came round, and the school day drew to an end. That was the point at which she would have to follow her and see where she went. Then the thought occurred to Mara Motswe that following a child could be problematic. It was one thing to follow somebody driving a car. All you had to do was tail them in the little white van. But if the person you were watching was riding a bicycle, as many children did, then it would look rather odd if the little white van were to be seen crawling along the road. If she walked home, of course, then Mara Motswe could herself walk, keeping a reasonable distance behind her. On the day following her interview with Mr. Patel, Mara Motswe parked the tiny white van in the school car park shortly before the final bell of the day sounded. The children came out in dribs and drabs, and it was not until shortly after 3:20 that Nandira walked out of the school entrance, carrying her school bag in one hand and a book in the other. She was by herself, and Mara Motswe was able to get a good look at her from the cab of her van. She was an attractive child, a young woman, really. One of those 16-year-olds who could pass for 19, or even 20. She walked down the path and stopped briefly to talk to another girl, who was waiting for her parents to collect her. They chatted for a few minutes, and then Nandira walked off towards the school gates. Mara Motswe waited a few moments, and then got out of the van. Once Nandira was out on the road, Mara Motswe followed her slowly. On a late winter afternoon, it was quite pleasant to walk down the road. A month or so later, it would be too hot, and then she could well appear out of place. She followed the girl down the road and round the corner. It had become clear to her that Nandira was not going directly home, as the Patel house was in the opposite direction to the route she had chosen. Nor was she going into town, which meant that she must be going to meet somebody at a house somewhere. Mara Motswe felt a glow of satisfaction. All she would probably have to do was to find the house, and then it would be child's play to get the name of the owner and the boy. Perhaps she could even go to Mr. Patel this evening and reveal the boy's identity. That would impress him. Nandira turned another corner. Mara Motswe held back a little before following her. It would be easy to become overconfident following an innocent child, and she had to remind herself of the rules of pursuit. The Principles of Private Investigation, by Clovis Anderson, stressed that one should never crowd one's subject. "Keep a long rein," wrote Mr. Anderson, "even if it means losing the subject from time to time. You can always pick up the trail later. And a few minutes of non-eye contact is better than an angry confrontation." Mara Motswe judged that it was now time to go round the corner. She did so, expecting to see Nandira several hundred yards down the road, but when she looked down it, the road was empty. Non-eye contact, as Clovis Anderson called it, had set in. Mara Motswe turned round and looked in the other direction. There was a car in the distance, coming out of the driveway of a house, and nothing else. It was a quiet road, and there were not more than 3 houses on either side of it, at least in the direction in which Nandira had been going. But these houses all had gates and driveways. If she has gone into one of the houses, thought Mara Motswe, then it must be one of the first 2, as she would certainly not have been able to reach the houses further along the road. So, perhaps the situation was not as bad as she had thought it might be. All she would have to do would be to check up on the first house on the right-hand side of the road and the first house on the left. Walking as quickly as she could, She made her way back to the tiny white van and drove back along the route on which she had so recently followed Nandira. Then, parking the van in front of the house on the right, she walked up the driveway towards the front door. When she knocked on the door, a dog started to bark loudly inside the house. Mara Motswe knocked again, and there came the sound of somebody silencing the dog.
"Quiet, Bison! Quiet! I know, I know!"
Then the door opened, and a woman looked out at her. She was a West African, probably a Ghanaian, judging by the complexion and the dress. Ghanaians were Mara Motswe's favourite people. They had a wonderful sense of humour and were almost inevitably in a good mood.
"Hallo, Ma," said Mara Motswe. "I'm sorry to disturb you, but I'm looking for Sipo."
The woman frowned.
"Sipo? There's no Sipo here."
Mara Motswe shook her head.
"I'm sure it was this house. I'm one of the teachers from the secondary school, you see, and I need to get a message to one of the Form 4 boys. I thought that this was his house."
The woman smiled.
"I've got two daughters," she said, "but no son. Would you find me a son, do you think?"
"Oh dear," said Mara Motswe, sounding harassed. "Is it the house over the road, then?"
The woman shook her head.
"That's that Ugandan family," she said. "They've got a boy, but he's only 6 or 7, I think."
Mara Motswe made her apologies and walked back down the drive. Could Nandira possibly have known that she was being followed? This seemed most unlikely, which meant that it was no more than bad luck that she had lost her. Tomorrow she would be more careful. She would crowd her subject a little more. At 8 o'clock that night, she received a telephone call from Mr. Patel.
"You have anything to report to me yet?"
he asked.
"Any information?"
Mara Motswe told him that she unfortunately had not been able to find out when Nandira went after school, but that she hoped that she might be more successful the following day.
"Not very good," said Mr. Patel. "Not very good. Well, I at least have something to report to you. She came home 3 hours after school finished. 3 hours! And told me that she had just been at a friend's house. I said, 'But friend?' And she just answered that I did not know her. Her. Then my wife found a note on the table. A note which Nandira must have dropped. It said, 'See you tomorrow, Jack.' Now, who is this Jack, then? Who is this person? Is that a girl's name, I ask you?"
"No," said Mara Motswe. "It sounds like a boy."
"There,"
said Mr. Patel, with the air of one producing the elusive answer to a problem.
"That is the one we must find. Jack who? Where does he live? That sort of thing. You must tell me it all."
Mara Motswe prepared herself a cup of bush tea and went to bed early. It had been an unsatisfactory day in more than one respect, and Mr. Patel's crowing telephone call merely set the seal on it. So she lay in bed, the bush tea on her bedside table, and read the newspaper before her eyelids began to droop, and she drifted off to sleep. The next afternoon, she saw Nandira come out of the school, accompanied by another girl. They seemed deep in conversation with one another, in that exclusive way which teenagers have of talking to their friends, and Mara Motswe was sure that if she only could hear what was being said, then she would know the answers to more than one question. Girls talked about their boyfriends in an easy, conspiratorial way, and she was certain that this was the subject of conversation between Nandira and her friend. Suddenly, a blue car drew up opposite the two girls. Mara Motswe stiffened and watched as the driver leant over the passenger seat and opened the front door. Nandira got in, and her friend got into the back. Mara Motswe pulled out of the school car park just as the blue car drew away from the school. She followed at a safe distance, but ready to close the gap between them if there was any chance of losing them. She would not repeat yesterday's mistake and see Nandira vanish into thin air. They drove past the Sun Hotel and made their way towards the stadium roundabout. There they turned in towards town and drove past the hospital and the Anglican Cathedral towards the Mall. Shops, thought Mara Motswe. They're just going shopping. Or are they?
She had seen teenagers meeting one another after school in places like the Botswana Book Centre. They called it hanging around, she believed. They stood about and chatted and cracked jokes and did everything except buy something. Perhaps Nandira was going off to hang around with this Jack. The blue car nosed into a parking place near the President Hotel. Mara Motswe parked several cars away and watched as the two girls got out of the car, accompanied by an older woman, presumably the mother of the other girl. She said something to her daughter, who nodded, and then detached herself from the girls and walked off in the direction of the hardware stores. Nandira and her friend walked past the steps of the President Hotel and then slowly made their way up to the post office. Mara Motswe followed them casually, stopping to look at a rack of African print blouses which a woman was displaying in the square.
"Buy one of these, Ma," said the woman. "Very good blouses. They never run. Look, this one I'm wearing has been washed 10, 20 times and hasn't run. Look."
Mara Motswe looked at the woman's blouse. The colours had certainly not run. She glanced out of the corner of her eye at the two girls. They were looking in the shoe shop window.
"You wouldn't have my size," said Mara Motswe. "I need a very big blouse."
The trader checked her rack and then looked at Mara Motswe again.
"You're right," she said. "You are too big for these blouses. Far too big."
Mara Motswe smiled.
"But they are nice blouses, Ma, and I hope you sell them to some nice small person."
She moved on. The girls were strolling up towards the book centre. Mara Motswe had been right. They were planning to hang about. There were very few people in the Botswana Book Centre. Three or four men were paging through magazines in the periodical section, and one or two people were looking at books. The assistants were leaning over the counters, gossiping idly. Mara Motswe noticed that the two girls were at the far end of the shop, looking at a shelf of books in the Setswana section. What were they doing there? Nandira could be learning Setswana at school, but she would hardly be likely to be buying any of the school books or biblical commentaries that dominated that section. No, they must be waiting for somebody. Mara Motswe walked purposefully to the African section and reached for a book. It was The Snakes of Southern Africa, and it was well illustrated. She gazed at a picture of a short brown snake and asked herself whether she had seen one of these. Her cousin had been bitten by a snake like that years ago, when they were children, and had come to no harm. Was that the snake? She looked at the text below the picture and read. It could well have been the same snake, because it was described as non-venomous and not at all aggressive. But it had attacked her cousin. Or had her cousin attacked it? Boys threw stones at them and seemed unable to leave them alone. But she was not sure whether Putoke had done that. It was so long ago, and she could not really remember. She looked over at the girls. They were standing there, talking to one another again, and one of them was laughing. Some story about boys, thought Mara Motswe. Well, let them laugh. They'll realise soon enough that the whole subject of men was not very funny. In a few years' time it would be tears, not laughter, thought Mara Motswe grimly. She returned to her perusal of The Snakes of Southern Africa. Now this was a bad snake, this one. Look at the head! Oh! And those evil eyes! Mara Motswe shuddered and read, "The above picture is of an adult male black mamba, measuring 1.87 metres. As is shown in the distribution map, this snake is to be found throughout the region, although it has a certain preference for open veld. It differs from the green mamba both in distribution, habitat, and toxicity of venom. The snake is one of the most dangerous snakes to be found in Africa, being outranked in this respect only by the Gaboon viper, a rare forest-dwelling snake found in certain parts of the eastern districts of Zimbabwe. Accounts of attacks by black mambas are often exaggerated, and stories of the snakes attacking men on galloping horses and overtaking them are almost certainly apocryphal. The mamba can manage a considerable speed over a very short distance, but could not compete with a horse. Nor are the stories of virtually instantaneous death necessarily true, although the action of the venom can be speeded if the victim of the bite should panic. In one reliably recorded case, a 26-year-old man in good physical condition sustained a mamba bite on his right ankle after he had stepped on the snake in the bush. The victim possibly succeeded in draining off some of the venom when he inflicted deep cuts on the site of the bite, not a course of action which is today regarded as helpful. He then walked some 4 miles through the bush to seek help and was admitted to hospital within 2 hours. Antivenom was administered and the victim survived unscathed. Had it been a puff adder bite, of course, there would have been considerable necrotic damage within that time, and he may even have lost the leg. Mara Motswe paused. One leg. He would need to have an artificial leg. Mr. Patel, Nandira! She looked up sharply. The snake book had so absorbed her that she had not been paying attention to the girls, and now they were gone. She pushed the snakes of southern Africa back onto the shelf and rushed out into the square. There were more people about now, as many people did their shopping in the latter part of the afternoon to escape the heat. There were some teenagers a little way away, but they were boys. No, there was a girl. But was it Nandira? No. She looked in the other direction. There was a man parking his bicycle under a tree, and she noticed that the bicycle had a car aerial on it. Why? She set off in the direction of the President Hotel. Perhaps the girls had merely gone back to the car to rejoin the mother, in which case everything would be all right. But when she got to the car park, she saw the blue car going out at the other end, with just the mother in it. So the girls were still around. Mara Motswe went back to the steps of the President Hotel and looked out over the square. She moved her gaze systematically, as Clovis Anderson recommended, looking at each group of people, scrutinising each knot of shoppers outside each shop window. There was no sign of the girls. She noticed the woman with the rack of blouses. She had a packet of some sort in her hand, and was extracting what looked like a mopani worm from within it. "Mopani worms?" asked Mara Motswe. The woman turned round and looked at her. "Yes." She offered the bag to Mara Motswe, who helped herself to one of the dry tree worms and popped it into her mouth. It was a delicacy she simply could not resist. "You must see everything that goes on, Ma," she said as she swallowed the worm, "standing here like this." The woman laughed. "I see everybody, everybody." "Did you see 2 girls come out of the book center?" asked Mara Motswe. "One Indian girl and 1 African girl, the Indian one about so high." The trader picked out another worm from her bag and popped it into her mouth. "I saw them," she said. "They went over to the cinema. Then they went off somewhere else. I didn't notice where they were going." Mara Motswe smiled. "You should be a detective," she said. "Like you," said the woman simply. This surprised Mara Motswe. She was quite well known, but she had not necessarily expected a street trader to know who she was. She reached into her handbag and extracted a 10-puller note, which she pressed into the woman's hand. "Thank you," she said. "That's a fee from me, and I hope you will be able to help me again sometime." The woman seemed delighted. "I can tell you everything," she said. "I am the eyes of this place. This morning, for example, do you want to know who was talking to whom just over there? Do you know? You'd be surprised if I told you." "Some other time," said Mara Motswe. "I'll be in touch." There was no point in trying to find where Nandira had got to now, but there was every point in following up the information that she already had. So Mara Motswe went to the cinema and inquired as to the time of that evening's performance, which is what she concluded the 2 girls had been doing. Then she returned to the little white van and drove home to prepare herself for an early supper and an outing to the cinema. She had seen the name of the film. It was not something she wanted to sit through, but it had been at least a year since she had been to the cinema, and she found that she was looking forward to the prospect. Mr. Patel telephoned before she left.
"My daughter has said that she is going out to see a friend about some homework," he said peevishly. "She is lying to me again."
"Yes," said Mara Motswe. "I'm afraid that she is. But
I know where she's going, and I shall be there. Don't you worry.
She's going to see this Jack, shouted Mr. Patel. She's meeting this boy?
Probably, said Mara Motswe. But there is no point in your upsetting yourself. I will give you a report tomorrow.
Early, please, said Mr. Patel. I'm always up at 6. Sharp, sharp.
There were very few people in the cinema when Mara Motswe arrived. She chose a seat in the penultimate row at the back. This gave her a good view of the door through which anybody entering the auditorium would have to pass. And even if Nandira and Jack came in after the lights had gone down, it would still be possible for Mara Motswe to pick them out. Mara Motswe recognized several of the customers. Her butcher arrived shortly after she did, and he and his wife gave her a friendly wave. Then there was one of the teachers from the school, and the woman who ran the aerobics class at the President Hotel. Finally, there was the Catholic bishop, who arrived by himself and ate popcorn loudly in the front row. Nandira arrived 5 minutes before the first part of the programme was about to start. She was by herself, and she stood for a moment in the door, looking around her. Mara Motswe felt her eyes rest on her, and she looked down quickly. After a moment or two, she looked up again and saw that the girl was still looking at her. Nandira walked purposefully across the auditorium to Mara Motswe's row and sat down in the seat next to her.
"Evening, Ma," she said politely. "Is this seat taken?"
"There is nobody there," she said. "It is quite free." Nandira sat down.
"I am looking forward to this film," she said pleasantly. "I have wanted to see it for a long time."
"Good," said Mara Motswe. "It is nice to see a film that you've always wanted to see." There was a silence. The girl was looking at her, and Mara Motswe felt quite uncomfortable. What would Clovis Anderson have done in such circumstances? She was sure that he said something about this sort of thing, but she could not quite remember what it was. This was where the subject crowded you, rather than the other way round.
"I saw you this afternoon," said Nandira. "I saw you at Maruapula."
"Ah, yes," said Mara Motswe. "I was waiting for somebody."
"Then I saw you in the book center," Nandira continued. "You were looking at a book."
"That's right," said Mara Motswe. "I was thinking of buying a book."
"Then you asked Maba Pizze about me,"
Nandira said quietly.
"That trader. She told me that you were asking about me."
Mara Motswe made a mental note to be careful of Maba Pizze in the future.
"So why are you following me?"
asked Nandira, turning to stare at Mara Motswe. Mara Motswe thought quickly. There was no point in denying it. She may as well try to make the most of a difficult situation. So she told Nandira about her father's anxieties and how he had approached her. "He wants to find out whether you're seeing boys. He's worried about it." Nandira looked pleased.
"Well, he's only got himself to blame if I keep going out with boys."
"And are you?" asked Mara Motswe. "Going out with lots of boys?" Nandira hesitated. Then quietly,
"No, not really."
"But what about this Jack?" asked Mara Motswe. "Who's he?" For a moment it seemed as if Nandira was not going to reply. He was another adult trying to pry into her private life. And yet there was something about Mara Motswe that she trusted.
"Jack doesn't exist," she said quietly. "I made him up. I want my family to think I've got a boyfriend. I want them to think there's somebody I chose, not somebody they thought right for me."
She paused.
"Do you understand that?"
Mara Motswe thought for a moment. She felt sorry for this poor, overprotected girl, and imagined just how in such circumstances one might want to pretend to have a boyfriend. "Yes," she said,
laying a hand on Nandira's arm. I understand. Nandira fidgeted with her watch strap.
Are you going to tell him?
She asked.
Well, I can hardly say that I've seen you with a boy called Jack when he doesn't really exist.
Nandira sighed.
Well, I suppose it's been a silly game.
She paused.
But once he realizes that there's nothing in it, do you think that he might let me have a bit more freedom? Do you think that he might let me live my life for a little without having to tell him how I spent every single minute?
I could try to persuade him, said Mara Motswe. I don't know whether he listened to me, but I could try.
Please, said Nandira, please try.
They watched the film together, and both enjoyed it. Then Mara Motswe drove Nandira back in her tiny white van, in a companionable silence, and dropped her at the gate in the high white wall. The girl stood and watched as the van drove off, and then she turned and pressed the bell.
Batel, place here. What do you want?
Freedom,
she muttered under her breath, and then more loudly,
It's me, Papa. I'm home now.
Mara Motswe telephoned Mr. Patel early the next morning and explained to him that it would be better for her to speak to him at home rather than to explain matters over the telephone.
You've got bad news for me,
he said, his voice rising.
You are going to be telling me something bad, bad. Oh, my God, what is it?
Mara Motswe reassured him that the news was not bad, but she still found him looking anxious when she was shown into his study half an hour later.
I am very worried, he said. You will not understand a father's worries. It is different for a mother. A father feels a special sort of worry.
Mara Motswe smiled reassuringly.
The news is good, she said. There is no boyfriend.
And what about this note?
He said.
What about this Jack person? Is that all imagination?
Yes, said Mara Motswe simply. It is.
Mr. Patel looked puzzled. He opened his mouth to speak, but said nothing.
You see, said Mara Motswe, Nandira has been inventing a social life for herself. She made up a boyfriend just to bring a bit of freedom into her life. The best thing you can do is just to ignore it. Give her a bit more time to lead her own life. Don't keep asking her to account for her time. There's no boyfriend, and there may not even be one for some time.
Mr. Patel closed his eyes and appeared deep in thought.
Why should I do this?
He said after a while.
Why should I give in to these modern ideas?
Because if you don't, then the imaginary boyfriend may turn into a real one. That's why.
Mara Motswe watched him as he wrestled with her advice. Then, without warning, he stood up, tottered for a while before he got his balance, and then turned to face her.
You are a very clever woman, he said, and I'm going to take your advice. I will leave her to get on with her life, and then I'm sure that in 2 or 3 years she will agree with us and allow me to help her to find a suitable man to marry.
That could easily happen,
said Mara Motswe, breathing a sigh of relief.
Yes,
said Mr. Patel warmly.
And I shall have you to thank for it all.
Mara Motswe often thought about Nandira when she drove past the Patel compound with its high white wall. She expected to see her from time to time, now that she knew what she looked like, but she never did. At least, not until a year later, when, while taking her Saturday morning coffee on the veranda of the President Hotel, she felt somebody tap her shoulder. She turned round in her seat, and there was Nandira, with a young man. The young man was about 18, she thought, and he had a pleasant, open expression.
Mara Motswe,
said Nandira in a friendly way.
I thought it was you.
Mara Motswe shook Nandira's hand. The young man smiled at her.
This is my friend, said Nandira. I don't think you've met him.
The young man stepped forward and held out his hand. Jack, he said.
Mara Motswe drove her tiny white van before dawn along the sleeping roads of Habrone, past the Kalahari breweries, past the Drylands research station, and out onto the road that led north. A man leapt out from the bushes at the side of the road and tried to flag her down, but she was unwilling to stop in the dark, for you never knew who might be wanting a lift at such an hour. In her mirror she saw him deflate with disappointment. Then, just past the Machudi turnoff, the sun came up, rising over the wide plains that stretched away towards the course of the Limpopo. Suddenly it was there, smiling on Africa, a slither of golden red ball, inching up, floating effortlessly free of the horizon, to dispel the last wisps of morning mist. The thorn trees stood clear in the sharp light, and there were birds upon them, and in-flight hoopoes, lowries, and tiny birds which she could not name. Here and there cattle stood at the fence which followed the road for mile upon mile. They raised their heads and stared, or ambled slowly on, tugging at the tufts of dry grass that clung tenaciously to the hardened earth. This was a dry land. Just a short distance to the west lay the Kalahari, a hinterland of ochre that stretched off for unimaginable miles to the singing emptiness of the Namib. If she turned her tiny white van off on one of the tracks that struck off from the main road, she could drive for perhaps 30 or 40 miles before her wheels would begin to sink into the sand and spin hopelessly. The vegetation would become sparser, more desert-like. The thorn trees would thin out, and there would be ridges of thin earth through which the omnipresent sand would surface and crenellate. There would be patches of bareness and scattered grey rocks, and there would be no sign of human activity. To live with this great dry interior, brown and hard, was the lot of the Botswana, and it was this that made them cautious and careful in their husbandry. If you went there, out into the Kalahari, you might hear lions by night, for the lions were there still, on these wide landscapes, and they made their presence known in the darkness, in coughing grunts and growls. She had been there once as a young woman, when she had gone with her friend to visit a remote cattle post. It was as far into the Kalahari as cattle could go, and she had felt the utter loneliness of a place without people. This was Botswana distilled, the essence of her country. It was the rainy season, and the land was covered with green. Rain could transform it so quickly, and the ground was covered with shoots of sweet new grass, Namaqualand daisies, the vines of Tsama melons, and aloes with stalk flowers of red and yellow. They had made a fire at night, just outside the crude huts which served as shelter at the cattle post, but the light from the fire seemed so tiny under the great empty night sky with its dipping constellations. She had huddled close to her friend, who had told her that she should not be frightened, because lions would keep away from fires, as would supernatural beings, tokoloshes and the like. She awoke in the small hours of the morning, and somewhere, far away, there was a grunting sound. But she was not afraid, and she walked out of the hut to stand underneath the sky and draw the dry, clear air into her lungs. And she thought, I am just a tiny person in Africa, but there is a place for me, and for everybody, to sit down on this earth and touch it and call it their own. She waited for another thought to come, but none did, and so she crept back into the hut and the warmth of the blankets on her sleeping mat. Now, driving the tiny white van along those rolling miles, she thought that one day she might go back into the Kalahari, into those empty spaces, those wide grasslands that broke and broke the heart. It was 3 days after the satisfactory resolution of the Patel case. Mara Motswe had put in her bill for 2,000 pula, plus expenses, and had been paid by return of post. She could not believe that she would be paid such a sum without protest, and the readiness and apparent cheerfulness with which Mr. Patel had settled the bill induced pangs of guilt over the size of the fee. It was curious how some people had a highly developed sense of guilt, she thought, while others had none. Some people would agonize over minor mistakes on their part, while others would feel quite unmoved by their own gross acts of dishonesty. Ma Pekwane fell into the former category, thought Ma Ramotswe. Note Makoti fell into the latter. Ma Pekwane had seemed anxious when she had come into the office of the number one ladies detective agency. Ma Ramotswe had given her a strong cup of bush tea and had waited for her to be ready to speak. She was anxious about a man, she thought. There were all the signs. What would it be? Some piece of masculine bad behaviour, of course, but what?
I'm worried that my husband had done a dreadful thing, said Ma Pekwane eventually. I feel very ashamed for him.
Ma Ramotswe nodded her head gently. Men do terrible things, she said. All wives are worried about their husbands. You are not alone. Ma Pekwane sighed.
But my husband has done a terrible thing, a very terrible thing.
Ma Ramotswe stiffened. If Ra Pekwane had killed somebody, she would have to make it quite clear that the police should be called in. She would never dream of helping anybody conceal a murderer. What is this terrible thing? She asked.
He has a stolen car.
Ma Ramotswe was relieved. Car theft was rife, almost unremarkable, and there must be many women driving around the town in their husbands' stolen cars. Ma Ramotswe could never imagine herself doing that, of course, and nor, it seemed, could Ma Pekwane.
Did he tell you it's stolen? She asked. Are you sure of it?
Ma Pekwane shook her head.
He said a man gave it to him. He said that this man had two Mercedes Benzes and only needed one.
Ma Ramotswe laughed.
Do men really think they can fool us that easily? She said. Do they think we're fools?
She looked at Ma Pekwane.
Do you want me to tell you what to do? Is that what you want?
Ma Pekwane looked thoughtful.
No,
she replied.
I don't want that. I've decided what I want to do. I want to give the car back. I want the car to get back to its owner without the police knowing. I want the law to know that the car's back where it belongs.
It was, Ma Ramotswe had to admit, a perfectly reasonable thing to want. If the car were to be returned to the owner, then Ma Pekwane's conscience would be clear and she would still have her husband. On reflection, it seemed to Ma Ramotswe to be a very good way of dealing with a difficult situation.
But why come to me about this? Asked Ma Ramotswe. How can I help?
Ma Pekwane gave her answer without hesitation.
I want you to find out who owns that car. Then I want you to steal it from my husband and give it back to the rightful owner. That's all I want you to do.
That evening, as she drove home in her little white van, Ma Ramotswe thought that she should never have agreed to help Ma Pekwane. But she had, and now she was committed. Yet it was not going to be a simple matter, unless, of course, one went to the police, which she clearly could not do. Her client had asked that this should not happen, and her first loyalty was to the client. So some other way would have to be found. That evening after her supper of chicken and pumpkin, Ma Ramotswe telephoned Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni.
Where do stolen Mercedes-Benzes come from? Asked Ma Ramotswe.
From over the border, said Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni. They steal them in South Africa, bring them over here, respray them, file off the original engine number, and then sell them cheaply or send them up to Zambia. I know who does all this. We all know.
I don't need to know that, said Ma Ramotswe. What I need to know is how you identify them after all this has happened.
You have to know where to look. Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni said. There's usually another serial number on the chassis or under the bonnet. You can usually find it if you know what you're doing. You know what you're doing, said Mara Motswe. Can you help me? Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni sighed. He preferred to have nothing to do with stolen cars, but this was a request from Mara Motswe, and so there was only one answer to give. Tell me where and when, he said. They entered the Pekwane garden the following evening, by arrangement with Ma Pekwane, who had promised that at the agreed time she would make sure that the dogs were inside and her husband would be busy eating a special meal she would prepare for him. So there was nothing to stop Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni from wriggling under the Mercedes-Benz parked in the yard and flashing his torch up into the bodywork. 10 minutes later, he had a serial number written on a piece of paper, and the two of them made their way to the small white van parked down the road. "Are you sure that's all I'll need?" asked Mara Motswe. "Will they know from that?"
"Yes," said Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni. "They'll know."
She dropped him off outside his gate, and he waved goodbye in the darkness. She would be able to repay him soon, she knew. That weekend, Mara Motswe drove her tiny white van over the border to Mafeking and went straight to the railway cafe. She bought a copy of the Johannesburg Star and sat at a table near the window reading the news. It was all bad, she decided, and so she laid the paper to one side and passed the time by looking at her fellow customers.
Mara Motswe!
She looked up. There he was, the same old Billy Pilani. Older now, of course, but otherwise the same. She could just see him at the Machudi government school, sitting at his desk, dreaming. She bought him a cup of coffee and a large doughnut and explained to him what she needed.
I want you to find out who owns this car, she said, passing the slip of paper with the serial number written on it. Then, when you found out, I want you to tell the owner, or the insurance company, or whoever, that they can come up to Habroni and they will find their car ready for them in an agreed place. All they have to do is bring South African number plates with the original number on them. Then they can drive the car home.
Billy Pilani looked surprised.
All for nothing? He asked. Nothing to be paid?
Nothing, said Mara Motswe. It's just a question of returning the property to its rightful owner. That's all. You believe in that, don't you, Billy?
Oh, of course, said Billy Pilani quickly.
And Billy, I want you to forget you're a policeman while all this is going on. There's not going to be any arrest for you.
Not even a small one?
Asked Billy in a disappointed tone.
Not even that.
Billy Pilani telephoned the following day.
I've got the details from our list of stolen vehicles, he said. I've spoken to the insurance company, who've already paid out, so they'd be very happy to get the car back. They can send one of their men over the border to pick it up.
Good, said Mara Motswe. They are to be in the African Mall in Habrone at 7 o'clock in the morning, next Tuesday, with the number plates.
Everything was agreed, and at 5 o'clock on the Tuesday morning, Mara Motswe crept into the yard of the Pekwane house and found, as she had been expecting, the keys of the Mercedes-Benz lying on the ground outside the bedroom window where Ma Pekwane had tossed them the previous night. She had been assured by Ma Pekwane that her husband was a sound sleeper and never woke up until Radio Botswana broadcast the sound of cowbells at 6. It was not until almost 8 o'clock that he noticed that his Mercedes-Benz was stolen.
Call the police, shouted Ma Pekwane. Quick, call the police.
She noticed that her husband was hesitating.
Maybe later, he said. In the meantime, I think I shall look for it myself.
She looked him directly in the eye, and for a moment she saw him flinch.
He's guilty, she thought. I was right all along. Of course he can't go to the police and tell them that his stolen car has been stolen.
She saw Mara Motswe later that day and thanked her.
You've made me feel much better, she said. I shall now be able to sleep at night without feeling guilty for my husband.
I'm very pleased, said Mara Motswe, and maybe he's learned a lesson too. A very interesting lesson.
What would that be?
Asked Ma Pekwane.
that lightning always strikes in the same place twice, said Mara Motswe, whatever people say to the contrary.
Mara Motswe's house had been built in 1968, when the town inched out from the shops and the government buildings. It was on a corner site, which was not always a good thing, as people would sometimes stand on that corner and spit into her garden or throw their rubbish over her fence. At first, when she saw them doing that, she would shout from the window, but they seemed to have no shame, these people, and they just laughed. So she gave up, and the young man who did her garden for her every third day would just pick up the rubbish and put it away. That was the only problem with that house. For the rest, Mara Motswe was fiercely proud of it, and daily reflected on her good fortune in being able to buy it when she did, just before house prices went so high that honest people could no longer pay them. The yard was a large one, almost two-thirds of an acre, and it was well endowed with trees and shrubs. The trees were nothing special, thorn trees for the most part, but they gave good shade, and they never died if the rains were bad. Then there were the purple bougainvilleas, which had almost taken over by the time Mara Motswe came. She had to cut these back to give space for her pawpaws and her pumpkins. At the front of the house there was a veranda, which was her favourite place, and which was where she liked to sit in the mornings when the sun rose, or in the evenings before the mosquitoes came out. She had extended it by placing an awning of shade netting supported by rough-hewn poles. These filtered out many of the rays of the sun and allowed plants to grow in the green light it created. There she had elephant ear and ferns, which she watered daily, and which made a lush patch of green against the brown earth. Behind the veranda was the living room, the largest room in the house, with its big window that gave out onto what had once been a lawn. There was a fireplace here, too large for the room, but a matter of pride for Mara Motswe. On the mantelpiece she had placed her special china, her Queen Elizabeth II teacup, and her commemoration plate, with a picture of Sir Seretse Khama, President, Khosi of the Bankwato people, statesman. He smiled at her from the plate, and it was as if he gave a blessing, as if he knew. As did the Queen, for she loved Botswana too, and understood. But in pride of place was the photograph of her daddy, taken just before his 60th birthday. He was smiling, although she knew that by then he was in pain. Mara Motswe was a realist, who inhabited the present, but one nostalgic thought she allowed herself, one indulgence, was to imagine her daddy walking through the door and greeting her again and smiling at her and saying, "My precious, you have done well. I am proud of you." But she could not allow herself to think like this too often, for it ended in tears, for all that was past and for all the love that she had within her. The kitchen was cheerful. The cement floor, sealed and polished with red floor paint, was kept shining by Mara Motswe's maid, Rose, who had been with her for 5 years. Rose had four children, by different fathers, who lived with her mother at Tlokweng. She worked for Mara Motswe and did knitting for a knitting cooperative, and brought her children up with the little money that there was. The oldest boy was a carpenter now, and was giving his mother money, which helped. But the little ones were always needing shoes and new trousers, and one of them could not breathe well and needed an inhaler. But Rose still sang, and this was how Mara Motswe knew she had arrived in the morning, as the snatches of song came drifting in from the kitchen. Happiness? Mara Motswe was happy enough. With her detective agency and her house in Zebra Drive, she had more than most and was aware of it. She was also aware that when she had been married to Note Makoti, she had been conscious of a deep, overwhelming unhappiness that followed her around like a black dog. That had gone now. If she had listened to her father, she would never have married Note, and the years of unhappiness would never have occurred. But they did, because she was headstrong, as everybody is at the age of 20, and when we simply cannot see, however much we think we can. The world is full of 20-year-olds, she thought, all of them blind. Obed Ramotswe had never taken to Note, and had told her that directly. but she had responded by crying and by saying that he was the only man she would ever find and that he would make her happy.
"He will not," said Obed. "That man will hit you. He will use you in all sorts of ways. He thinks only of himself and what he wants. I can tell, because I have been in the mines, and you see all sorts of men there. I have seen men like that before."
She had shaken her head and rushed out of the room, and he had called out after her, a thin, pained cry. She could hear it now, and it cut and cut at her. She had hurt the man who loved her more than any other, a good, trusting man who only wanted to protect her. If only one could undo the past. If one could go back and avoid the mistakes, make different choices.
"If we could go back," said Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni, pouring tea into Mara Motswe's mug. "I have often thought that. If we could go back and know then what we know now."
He shook his head in wonderment.
"My goodness, I would live my life differently."
Mara Motswe sipped at her tea. She was sitting in the office of Klokweng Road Speedy Motors, passing the time of day with her friend, as she sometimes did when her own office was quiet. This was inevitable. Sometimes people simply did not want to find things out. Nobody was missing. Nobody was cheating on their wives. Nobody was embezzling. At such times, a private detective may as well hang a clothes sign on the office door and go off to plant melons. Not that she intended to plant melons. A quiet cup of tea followed by a trip to the book centre and see if any interesting magazines had arrived was as good a way of spending the afternoon as any. She loved magazines. She loved their smell and their bright pictures. She loved interior design magazines, which showed how people lived in faraway countries. They had so much in their houses, and such beautiful things too. Paintings, rich curtains, piles of velvet cushions, which would have been wonderful for a fat person to sit upon, strange lights at odd angles. Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni warmed to his theme.
"I have made hundreds of mistakes in my lifetime," he said, frowning. "Hundreds and hundreds."
She looked at him. She had thought that everything had gone rather well in his life. He had served his apprenticeship as a mechanic, saved up his money, and then bought his own garage. He had built a house, married a wife, who had unfortunately died, and become the local chairman of the Botswana Democratic Party. He knew several ministers, very slightly, and was invited to one of the annual garden parties at State House. Everything seemed rosy.
"I can't see what mistakes you've made," she said, "unlike me."
Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni looked surprised.
"I can't imagine you making any mistakes," he said. "You're too clever for that."
Mara Motswe snorted.
"I married Note," she said simply.
Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni looked thoughtful.
"Yes," he said, "that was a bad mistake."
They were silent for a moment. Then he rose to his feet. He was a tall man, and he had to be careful not to bump his head when he stood erect. Now, he cleared his throat and spoke.
"I would like you to marry me," he said. "That would not be a mistake." Mara Motswe hid her surprise. She did not give a start, nor drop her mug of tea, nor open her mouth and make no sound. She smiled instead, and stared at her friend.
"You are a good, kind man," she said. "You are like my daddy, a bit. But I cannot get married again, ever. I am happy as I am. I have got the agency and the house. My life is full."
Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni sat down. He looked crestfallen, and Mara Motswe reached out to touch him. He moved away instinctively, as a burned man will move away from fire.
"I am very sorry," she said. "If I were ever to marry anybody, which I shall not do, I would choose a man like you. I would even choose you. I am sure of this."
Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni took her mug and poured her more tea. He was silent now, not out of anger or resentment,
but because it had cost him all his energy to make his declaration of love, and he had no more words for the time being. Alice Busang was nervous about consulting Mara Motswe, but was soon put at ease by the comfortable, overweight figure sitting behind the desk. It was rather like speaking to a doctor or a priest, she thought. In such consultations, nothing that one could possibly say would shock.
"I am suspicious of my husband," she said. "I think that he is carrying on with ladies."
Mara Motswe nodded. All men carried on with ladies in her experience. "Have you seen him doing this?" she asked. Alice Busang shook her head.
"I keep watching out, but I never see him with other women. I think he is too cunning."
Mara Motswe wrote this down on a piece of paper. "He goes to bars, does he?"
"Yes."
"That's where they meet them. They meet these women who hang about in bars, waiting for other women's husbands. This city is full of women like that." She looked at Alice, and there flowed between them a brief current of understanding. All women in Botswana were the victims of the fecklessness of men. There were virtually no men these days who would marry a woman and settle down to look after her children. Men like that seemed to be a thing of the past. "Do you want me to follow him?" she said. "Do you want me to find out whether he picks up other women?" Alice Busang nodded.
"Yes," she said. "I want proof, just for myself. I want proof so that I can know what sort of men I married."
Mara Motswe was too busy to take on the Busang case until the following week. That Wednesday, she stationed herself in her small white van outside the office in the Diamond Sorting Building where Kremlin Busang worked. She had been given a photograph of him by Alice Busang, and she glanced at this on her knee. This was a handsome man, with broad shoulders and a wide smile. He was a ladies' man by the look of him, and she wondered why Alice Busang had married him if she wanted a faithful husband. She followed him, her white van trailing his old blue car, through the traffic to the Go Go Handsome Man's bar down by the bus station. Then, while he strolled into the bar, she sat for a moment in her van and put a little more lipstick on her lips and a dab of cream on her cheeks. In a few minutes she would go in and begin work in earnest.